He's a person of integrity, and he's willing and ready to treat people with respect and dignity.
Governor Parnell fills a vacant Senate seat. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 8th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, protecting critical habitat for sea otters in southwest Alaska.
It would prevent the areas from being destroyed by future uses that we don't yet know of.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
North Pole Representative John Coghill has been chosen to replace Republican Jean Theriault in the state Senate. Theriault is now the governor's energy special assistant. Governor Parnell announced Coghill's appointment in Fairbanks this afternoon.
I feel that Representative Coghill has some current and unique experiences. He's a person of integrity. I've worked with him. I've seen him not only have and hold to his principles, but he's able to listen to people of different views, and he's willing and ready to treat people with respect and dignity.
Coghill is the current chairman of the House Rules Committee, a powerful position responsible for scheduling votes that appear on the House floor. Elected to the House in 1998, he previously served as majority leader. He is the son of former Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill. The Senate seat includes his own district in North Pole and the Valdez District. The nine Senate Republicans still have to concur in the appointment. Coghill says he doesn't foresee that as a problem, adding, "But you never know." Asked about that, Coghill recognized that there are two separate sets of Republicans in the Senate. Six are members of the majority coalition with Democrats, and four in an unrecognized minority. Both sets of Republicans must vote together on the appointment.
I have told people and indicated that the way the coalition is made up right now, I'm not particularly interested in joining that coalition, but I'm not willing to say I won't work with it either. So I think I'm open to discussion, but I don't anticipate joining the coalition at this point. There's, I guess, mostly philosophically driven.
Coghill's selection opens his House seat that Governor Parnell will now have to fill by appointment. It also opens a restructuring of the House majority as members have to find a new rules chairman. Federal workers in Alaska may soon start getting what's called locality pay instead of a COLA, or cost of living adjustment. The switch would put Alaska, Hawaii, and territories such as Puerto Rico in line with the rest of the country. Locality pay still makes salary adjustments based on geographic location, as COLA did, but the money does count toward retirement, whereas COLA does not. The switch is supported by Alaska and Hawaii's congressional delegations and is in a bill that passed the House today. The change in federal pay was prompted because COLA rates started decreasing this year. Congressman Don Young's chief of staff, Pamela Day, says their office began working on the issue 2 years ago when the Labor Department approached them with concerns COLA would drop. Day says unions in Alaska and federal workers asked them to get involved too.
When you go to locality pay, you're going to receive roughly the same amount, if not a little bit more, than you would with COLA. But on the flip side, when you retire, that amount of money is going to be counted in towards your pension payments. You actually make out much better in the long run.
One difference is that locality pay will be taxed, unlike COLA, but Day says it should balance out.
COLA is not taxed, locality pay is taxed. But because the COLA rates are coming down, locality pay more than makes up for the difference in the taxable income there.
Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich supported the legislation in the Senate. The switch would affect about 50,000 federal workers whose pay would be phased from COLA to locality pay over 3 years. It's in the final version of the Defense Authorization Bill, which passed the U.S. House today and will go before the Senate next week, where it's expected to pass and then be signed into law by the president. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Barrow dentist is recognized nationally for her work.
Now I see child after child who comes in for our 3 month checkup visits, and they're cavity free.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officially designated 5,855 acres as critical habitat for Southwest Alaska sea otters yesterday. The areas span from the end of the Aleutians to the Alaska Peninsula and mostly include nearshore areas and kelp beds. U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Woods says the designation only affects federal activities in the area.
Well, a critical habitat designation means that any federal agencies that either undertake, fund, or permit activities in that area are required to consult with the service to make sure that those activities don't either adversely modify or destroy the designated critical habitat.
That means the designation should not affect any commercial subsistence or sport fishing. Activities that might cause major environmental changes, like dredging or drilling for oil and gas, would have to be reviewed by the service before being approved.
It would prevent the areas from being destroyed by future uses that we don't yet know of.
The critical habitat designation is required under the Endangered Species Act because of Alaska's southwestern population of sea otters is considered threatened. Their population declined from 100,000 in the 1970s to less than 40,000 now. In the Aleutians, the population is less than 10,000. Woods says protecting the habitat is one step toward protecting the population.
We tried to determine areas that had everything that sea otters needed to live, but that also were areas that would allow sea otters to escape from predators, since one of the theories about the decline of the sea otter population is that it resulted from increased predation by killer whales. And so these are nearshore areas where killer whales are less likely to be, and it gives the otters an area where they could go to escape.
Wood says it's too soon to say if this will be enough to help rebuild the population. The area for the critical habitat designation was selected last year and put up for public comment after the service came to an agreement with the Center for Biological Diversity. The center sued Fish and Wildlife to get the otters listed as threatened in 2005 when the government did not designate any critical habitat. The center sued them again in 2006. The organization is also concerned about the potential impacts of oil and gas drilling in the North Aleutian Basin on the threatened otter populations. A 5-year lease plan for the area is currently under consideration by the Minerals Management Service. The city of Angoon has won a preliminary permit for studying a proposed power plant at Scenery Creek in Thomas Bay, north of Petersburg. It's one of three sites in the remote mainland bay under consideration for power generation. From KFSK in Petersburg, Joe Vicknicki reports.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued a preliminary permit October 1st that grants Angoon the right to study hydropower potential at Scenery Creek for the next 3 years. Angoon Mayor Albert Howard says getting the permit is a positive step and is one step in a long process.
I think now we want to move forward with it, and we'd like, you know, anyone that wants to be involved in the region, we expect a lot of input, and we'd like to have a lot of input and a lot of participation as much as, you know, people in the region want to. The door is open for anybody that wants to be a part of the project. So.
Angoon was the only applicant for the Scenery Creek project. The private company Cascade Creek had held a permit for the project until this year, but did not seek to renew it. Instead, the company is working with Angoon on Scenery Creek. About 430 people call Angoon home on the western side of Admiralty Island. It's about 70 miles from the Scenery Creek site. Howard says residents in his community pay 62 cents a kilowatt hour for diesel-generated electricity. That's as much as 5 to 6 times the cost of power in larger southeast towns like Petersburg that enjoy cheap hydroelectricity. Angoon's application says it plans to sell power to Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan, with money from those sales helping to reduce the cost of power generation in Angoon. As for its own power needs, Kootsnuwu, the village native corporation, is working to develop a hydropower plant on Thayer Creek near Angoon. Plans for developing the sites in Thomas Bay have met with opposition. Thomas Bay and Scenery Cove are popular destinations for Petersburg charter boats, small cruise ships, and local residents who frequent the area for recreation and subsistence uses. The city of Petersburg opposed Angoon's application for a preliminary permit. Mayor Al Dwyer says he's disappointed by the news.
I think we're going to lose access and the beauty of the place. The silence, it's just a beautiful place. And to develop that place, it just, it's a shocker. I know that Angoon's going to be probably using Cascade Creek or somebody like them to help them with this. That scares me, too.
Petersburg is competing with Angoon, Wrangell, and Cascade Creek to try and develop another site in Thomas Bay at Ruth Lake. Petersburg officials have repeatedly said they did not want to partner with the private company on the Ruth Lake project. In addition to concerns from Petersburg, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game also submitted a letter expressing concern over the proposed location of the powerhouse in an area of the creek that also supports coho, pink, and chum salmon, along with steelhead trout and Dolly Varden. The development would also be inside a roadless area of the Tongass National Forest. Angoon's Mayor Howard says he heard some of the concerns about the Scenery Creek site during a visit to Petersburg this summer and says Angoon will be careful about developing the area.
You know, I wouldn't go into someone's backyard or expect someone to come into my backyard and totally destroy the area for any reason. And I wouldn't do that to anyone or our community wouldn't do that. So we'll work with the people who have those concerns to make sure they're addressed and everyone's satisfied when they walk away. But you also got to consider that, you know, at some point the state is going to run out of money. And if we don't do any of these projects now, we're going to wish we had.
The project would mean a 15-foot-high concrete dam on Scenery Lake, 957 feet above sea level, in the far northeast corner of the bay. Water would be siphoned or tapped from the lake and dropped down a buried 13,000-foot-long penstock to a powerhouse near salt water. The power plant could have the capacity to generate up to 40 megawatts. Angoon will have 3 years to study the potential at the site and would have to apply for a federal license before actually developing Scenery Creek. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
A dentist from Barrow is in Washington, D.C. this evening to be recognized by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Amanda Gaynor Ashley will receive a Community Health Leaders Award tonight. She's being honored for her work that has helped improve oral health on the North Slope and for working with Illisogvic College to develop a program to train dental assistants. Dr. Gaynor Ashley says when she first came to Barrow in 1999, the community sometimes had a dentist working full-time, but also experienced periods where no dentists were available.
And so when I got there in 1999, I found a great disparity in the dental services that were available. And for many people, you know, they accessed the dental clinic only on an emergency basis.
The clinic was at one time dubbed the extraction clinic before you arrived. Why was that?
Yes, our clinic had come to be known as the extraction clinic, I think, because many people, by the time they were able to get access to the dental care, whether it was in Barrow or in our villages, the tooth decay had progressed to the point where there really was no other choice. And for me, an especially difficult part of that was when that happened in children, you know, and having to take out permanent teeth due to tooth decay in children was a very, very difficult thing when I first got up to Barrow.
And so what have you done to turn that around?
Well, we have partnered with the local community, the school districts. Our board of directors at the hospital has been extremely supportive, as well as the administration in Barrow. And we've brought a lot of focus onto outreach programs, prevention programs. So, for instance, we go to the elementary school and the middle school once a week to do a fluoride rinse program. We have fluoride now in the water in Barrow. We have kids clinics, which provide after-school appointments so that parents can more easily access dental care for their children without having to take the children out of school.
And what's been the response of the children involved? Do they regard you with fear, or did they initially, and how is that different now?
I think a big change came about when we had a dental assistant training program, and that was a program we started about 6 years ago. And since the dental assistant training program provides training for local residents to become dental health care professionals, that completely changed the way we were viewed in the community. So we went from being a place where, you know, there weren't a lot of familiar faces for the children to being a place where now the kids come in and they see their aunties, their cousins, their relatives, and also people that have been in the community for quite a while. That has had a tremendous impact in reducing the fear in children as they access dental care.
There is a program that I'm sure you're familiar with, that there's a training program that has come under fire from the American Dental Association in Alaska to train folks to go into rural communities and provide dental care. What are your thoughts about that program?
I am very supportive of the dental health aid training program, the therapist level, and all of the other levels. I think that it's an amazingly innovative program to connect people with access to dental care in areas where there otherwise would be no dental care provided. So I'm entirely in support of the program.
And what are you seeing in the years that you've been there? You've been there 10 years now. What are you seeing as far as attitudes from the kids that are involved? We hear a lot about the problems that kids have in rural communities with access to dental care, and also problems with soda pop and candy. What are you seeing about their attitudes and their awareness and thoughts on dental hygiene now?
I've seen a tremendous difference in the past 10 years. You know, it's gone from when I first got to Barrow, the attitude that I felt like the majority of people had was just that tooth loss was an inevitable consequence of living in rural Alaska. And now I see child after child who comes in for our 3 month checkup visits, and they're cavity free. You know, and they know how to properly brush their teeth. They put a high value on maintaining good oral hygiene, and they're also turning around to help their younger siblings and younger members of their family, you know, start off on the right foot and really access dental care early on.
Dr. Amanda Gaynor Ashley is a dentist in Barrow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Alaska Travel Industry Association is holding its annual meeting in Fairbanks this week, following on a season during which tourism volume slipped. ATIA Executive Director Ron Peck says cruise ship numbers were flat, and the number of air and road travelers appears to be down significantly.
Based on early indicators and metrics, we believe that the non-cruise visitor numbers will be down about 15%, from 674,000 visitors in 2008 to about 573,000 visitors. So in the aggregate, we will be down from 1.7 million to less than 1,600,000 visitors in 2009.
Peck says the situation was brought on by a mix of factors.
We're in a bit of a perfect storm. It's not fair for us to say it's one thing that caused it, but there are a myriad of things, including the global and U.S. recession, the economy. H1N1 impacted some of our Asian visitors. The fact that charter operators could only catch one fish recreationally, one halibut in Southeast Alaska, impacted Southeast also very dramatically. And I believe that the impact of the ballot initiative with increased costs on the cruise industry impacted the cruise industry and their cost structure.
Alaska Cruise Association President John Brinkley of Fairbanks says cruise operators adapted to maintain their numbers this summer, but are changing their tactics for next year.
The cruise lines had to discount the price so deeply that it was very tough financially. And so what they've decided is in 2010, they will bring less ships. Less ships will mean less people coming to Alaska. It will be about 30% less that come to South Central Alaska, and those are the ones that we depend on to try and get up to Denali and to Fairbanks. So this year we were down because of the economics. Next year we're going to be down because of less cruise ship passengers coming to Alaska.
The interior was hit particularly hard this summer as thousands fewer visitors made the trek north. The state of Alaska is awaiting a final ruling from the Superior Court in Anchorage before paying out more than $68 million to out-of-state residents who were overcharged for commercial fishing permits. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The over 30-year-old Carlson class action lawsuit has been subject to four separate Alaska Supreme Court rulings, but a conclusion could happen in the next few months. Lance Nelson is the Senior Assistant Attorney General for the state of Alaska. He says the practice of charging non-residents a different rate for commercial fishing permits dates back to before statehood and is a standard practice among states with commercial fisheries. Nelson says the practice in Alaska of charging non-residents 10 times what was charged residents was in place in the early 1950s.
When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the territorial establishment of that rate was unconstitutional. And my understanding is that after that ruling, it was adjusted to a multiplier of 3, and that carried over into statehood, and it was in place from statehood until the early 2000s here.
The case challenging the practice of charging different rates for non-residents was filed by Donald Carlson back in 1984, and it became a class action lawsuit in December of that year. Carlson and the other plaintiffs claimed that it was inappropriate for the state to charge 3 times more than residents for the same permit. Nelson says the state has always believed that it's appropriate to impose fees on non-residents for the privilege of commercial fishing in Alaska waters.
It's the cost that the state expends to take care of and manage our commercial fisheries in the state. And a non-resident doesn't participate in paying those costs.
Because the Carlson case is a class action lawsuit, it includes all persons who participated in one or more Alaska commercial fisheries at any time who paid non-resident assessments to the state for commercial or gear licenses or permits. The principal that the state owes to out-of-state permit holders is nearly $12.5 million, but Nelson confirms that the state is trying to limit its liability by resolving the case so that the amount of interest owed does not continue to grow.
The critical time of question is from 1984 to about 2004. So for most of that time of question, the rate has been around 11%, and it's been compounding quarterly, which is really the kicker that makes a huge difference. So we end up with, tens of millions of dollars total the state will owe in the case.
The interest owed by the state is approaching $56 million, which puts the total payout to plaintiffs in the case at over $68 million. At the moment, both the state and the plaintiffs are awaiting a final judgment from the Superior Court in Anchorage before any monies can be paid out. Again, Senior Assistant Attorney General Lance Nelson.
The court needs to decide now. It needs to decide whether the figures are correct. And the state, by the way, has retained an accounting firm to do an independent audit before we declare these to the court, from our point of view, to be final numbers. But the on top of what we've calculated so far, there will be probably some additional attorney's fees from the plaintiff's counsel that they'll be moving for, and several issues like that that need to be resolved before things will be final.
Once a final judgment is reached, the next step in the process will be for the Alaska legislature to dedicate money for the actual payments to plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit. It's anticipated that the legislature would take up the appropriation when the next session begins early next year. If an appropriation is made, payments could be released to plaintiffs in late 2010. The Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission notes that over 4.7 thousand plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit are currently scheduled to receive refunds. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska Airlines is doing better than its competitors, but it's still a tough market for air carriers. That's the word from Bill McKay, the airline's senior vice president for Alaska, who visited Sitka yesterday. He gave an update on the company's economic health and his concerns for the future. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
McKay told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce that Alaska Airlines is one of only two major U.S. carriers not to have filed for bankruptcy. But, he adds, in this economy, nobody is exactly flush with money.
I went up to, Andrew, Susan and I went to Southeast Conference in Haines and made a presentation. And I said, well, you know, what, Glenn, what should I, how should I describe our overall financial health? And he said, well, tell them we're top dog on the trash heap.
Of the last 4 years, only 2007 brought a profit for the Seattle-based airline. Last year, in 2008, the company lost about $136 million, but that was also the year that the price of oil pushed above $130 a barrel. McKay says he's optimistic about the future, but also concerned about dipping tourism traffic. And he acknowledged that Sitka has shared in the squeeze with the rest of Southeast Alaska. Fewer people coming in on cruises, fewer lodge guests, and the expectation of a big drop in cruise traffic next year. Alaska Airlines would like to get back to expanding its services at a rate of about 10% a year, McKay said. But he also says not to expect the airline to do too much expansion in the next 2 years.
Where we've pulled back some of our lower float 48 flying, principally in Mexico and so forth, and added some of this new business to Texas and in Atlanta, you may see us add a couple of frequencies there. But by and large, I think we'll be reasonably flat over the next, at least the next year, if not the next 2 years.
After the luncheon, McKay said that when times are tough, the first step is to offer discounts and deals before changing the schedule or raising fares.
You know, we really would rather not do either one. I mean, to cut a schedule, particularly in Southeast, where, you know, it's all so interdependent on the stop before or the stop, you know, beyond, that's the last thing we'd like to do. And we don't want to raise airfares either. So to the degree we're going to be able to stimulate, you know, additional travel, that's where we'll try to go first.
What happens next could very well depend on the company's third quarter results, which are set to be announced on October 22nd. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Dan Brass in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at uskh.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.